Hello, this is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 54, and today I'm joined via Skype by Catherine Zuckert, who is Nancy Reeves Drew Professor of Political Science at the University of Notre Dame. Professor Zuckert is the author of many books on the history of political philosophy and the relationship between literature and politics. I'll link to her CV on the blog, but I want to mention a few of her excellent books here in reverse chronological order. So there's Natural Right and the American Imagination, Political Philosophy in Novel Form by Roman and Litterfield in 1990, Postmodern Platos, Nietzsche, Heidegger, Gadamer, Strauss, and Derrida by the University of Chicago Press in 1996, The Truth About Leo Strauss, Political Philosophy and American Democracy with Michael Zuckert, that's University of Chicago Press, 2006. And her most recent book, Plato's Philosophers, The Coherence of the Dialogues, and it's this book, which was published in 2009 by the University of Chicago Press, that brings her to the digital dialogue today. So I had the privilege to review the book for the Notre Dame Philosophical Reviews recently, and upon its appearance, Catherine and I thought it would be a wonderful opportunity to engage in a more dynamic discussion of the book together here on the digital dialogue. So Catherine, welcome to the digital dialogue.
Thank you very much, Chris. I'm happy to be here.
It is great to have you. So we met, I think, first at the Michigan State when you were giving a talk at the Ancient Philosophy Society.
That was correct. In that case, Deborah Nails had asked me to give the talk, in fact, before I published Plato's Philosophers, but I took a part of the argument about Socrates and Timaeus out of Plato's Philosophers, in effect, to give us the lecture then.
Yes, and I think we did a digital dialogue after that that wonderful keynote address, and I think we have that. I'll link to that as well. So maybe you could take a little bit of time to just talk about the what informs your approach to the dialogues. I think one of the great things about this book is that it is so comprehensive and takes a really follows through on a unique approach to the dialogue. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Okay. This is, I think, not stated in the book, but the book about Plato's philosophers actually follows from postmodern Plato's in the following way. That the question, I think, raised by the contemporary philosophers going back to Plato is, what is it? What is philosophy? Mm-hmm. And that leads, I think this is a point actually I associate most emphatically with Hans-Georg Gadamer, to the observation that Plato writes dialogues. He doesn't write scientific treatises the way Aristotle does. He doesn't have an impersonal voice of his own, and he doesn't address an impersonal audience. Instead, he shows us or relates these conversations among particular individuals, all of whom have personalities, situations, reactions. And so in all cases, the arguments are filtered through the individuals or affected certainly by them and their interaction and their situation. I guess, overall thesis of Plato's philosophers is that if we want to know what Plato thought, we have to approach him as a playwright or, if you want, a puppeteer. He's the one who chooses which philosopher and which interlocutors are going to appear in any particular dialogue. So we first, I think, have to look at each one of the dialogues as a kind of prose play and then try to see how they go together, because Plato himself is not speaking through any particular one character. And I think it's a mistake to identify him with any one of the philosophic voices, even Socrates. So we have to look at the particular philosophers and the dialogues and then get to Plato as the one who organized them and I also think, created them. I don't think they're historical reports.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that there's a couple issues there that I think we can circle back to, one of which I'd like to come back to at some point is the question of the difference between Aristotle and Plato's writing styles. But let's bracket that one for a second and focus on the... what I think is really remarkable about the book, which is how it shows, by taking the dialogues in this dramatic order according to not the way they may or may, chronology of when they may or may not have been written, but according to the story that they tell, you really are able to articulate a compelling story about the life of Socrates, and even, I guess we have to talk about the pre-Socratic dimensions of Platonic of this story, because the Laws is, on your reading is a pre-Socratic text in the sense that it is dramatically taking place before Socrates' life, and then of course it also extends beyond Socrates' life in the sense that you have the Phaedo and the stories that I mean, maybe the Menexenus and other stories that sort of come afterwards.
Right.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about that sort of larger picture of the story that Plato tells in his writings.
Okay, I could say something about how I came to the story.
Yeah, that'd be
good. I actually began with the thesis that's announced in the title as opposed to the subtitle. Mm-hmm. That is that Plato depicts several distinct, different philosophical characters and voices. And I came to that primarily through studying the so-called trilogy, that is the Theaetetus, Sophist, and Statesman. Mm-hmm. So the breaking point was when it became clear to me in an animated debate with a student in a seminar that the Eleatic Stranger doesn't have an idea of the good. And the student kept saying, well, that's what he means. And I said, maybe what he means. I don't think so. That's not what he says. So that debate then led me not merely to contrast the Eleatic and Socrates, but going back from the Eleatic to go to Parmenides, which I initially thought was the first of the dialogues. And I can say, I think it is the first of the dialogues, but I'll explain that later.
Mm-hmm.
So I had studied the Eleatic, I'd studied Parmenides. At that point, I thought the Athenian Stranger was last. What was it going to do with Socrates? 33 out of the 35 dialogues.
Right.
And beginning with the Parmenides, in which everybody agrees Plato presents a very young Socrates at the beginning, I thought, well, let's just do an experiment. Let's see whether we can sort of trace the dialogues or line them up chronologically. And as I say, and I would emphasize, I think the dramatic dates give us a certain amount of internal evidence about the times at which Plato wanted us to imagine these conversations taking place. But they're controversial, and sometimes they're contradictory. Some of the conversations couldn't really have taken place, like the Republic and the Phaedrus, to name two big important examples.
Right.
So just use the dramatic dates as a way of saying, well, do they line up? And what I thought I found at the end was they did line up, so that one sees as a whole the dialogues tell the story of the rise of Socratic philosophy, and that's where the pre-Socratic comes in. That is, what were the problems to which Socrates was trying to respond?
Mm-hmm.
And I see the Laws and the Parmenides as giving the political and then the philosophical problems to which Socrates was attempting to respond. Then we have his autobiographical statements, which are later.
Mm-hmm.
And beginning then with his first sort of public appearance in the Protagoras, what you see is Socrates getting a reputation, Socrates successfully refuting his contemporaries, particularly their understandings of the noble and the good, but he's not attracting any students or regular companions. Mm-hmm. Critias and Alcibiades both go off. So then in, I think, the Symposium, Phaedrus, Republic, and Philebus, Socrates presents a more positive teaching and he begins to acquire his own students. Timaeus represents a philosophical challenge to Socrates, who never gives us a cosmology. And then after the Timaeus, what we see in some of the Olympic dialogues dated between 409 and 401 is that Socrates attracts some particularly argumentative kinds of fellows. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't attract and isn't able to benefit everyone. That leads to his trial, death, and the final challenge of the Eleatic Stranger, meaning that what the dramatic dialogues do is, or the dramatic dates do, is to enable us to line the dialogues up so they tell a story. Mm-hmm. And the story is of the rise of Socratic philosophy, or you know, why it was necessary, what Socrates could do, and then what he couldn't do, because there are also, I think, limitations to Socrates that are dramatized in the dialogues. And those limitations are particularly represented by the other philosophers, Timaeus and the Eleatic Stranger.
Right. So, I mean, I think the one thing that's so compelling about the book is the way that the picture emerges of a figure, namely Socrates, who is different from all of these other Platonic philosophers, the Athenian Stranger, Parmenides, Timaeus, and the Eleatic Stranger. So, and I think when you were just speaking at the end there about the question of limits and showing Socrates' limits and maybe a particular kind of relationship to limits, to finitude in general, that is part of at least what I take to be what Socrates is constantly aware of, that maybe the other Platonic philosophers are not as aware of, namely one's own relationship to one's finitude and the erotic dimensions of that. Do you think that's a fair kind of characterization? Basically, the question is, what is the difference between Socrates and these other philosophers?
Well, I think, as you've already indicated, Chris, it's easy to label the difference.
Yeah.
You say, right. Socrates is erotic.
Right.
And the Athenian, well, he's old. He's very erotic. And Timaeus is very dignified, and the Eleatic's very abstract. So and they don't take as much account of Eros as Socrates actually does. But then, of course, the big question is, what does it mean to be an erotic philosopher?
Right.
And there's a lot of funny drama in the dialogues, as you know, about Socrates being mistaken for a pederast, but he isn't really. That is, it becomes pretty clear, if no place else than Alcibiades' critique of Socrates in the Symposium, that Socrates didn't really look for young men because he wanted sexual partners. So I think what we find from Plato is that what it means to be an erotic philosopher, as imaged by Socrates, is to be attracted by the beautiful. But I think the beautiful, as described in the Phaedrus, where it's said to be the only one of the ideas or the things in itself that becomes manifest to us directly through our senses. Mm-hmm. So that's the place that you begin. And then I think it's the beginning of, as you indicated, looking outside and looking beyond yourself to something better. Mm-hmm. So to be an, in quotes, erotic philosopher is to recognize in various ways, beginning with your mortality, but then there are lots of implications of that, your own limitations. Mm-hmm. And then to recognize how much human striving is an attempt to overcome those limitations, and then a sort of evaluation of the various forms in which we try to overcome them.
Right. So this is getting very, this whole articulation of what it means to be an erotic philosopher, or actually an erotic person in this Platonic sense, that namely having a connection with these ideals like the beautiful, the just, and the good, and I think you're emphasis on the primacy in a certain sense of the beautiful is important. But I wonder on your view, is our erotic relationship to the beautiful substantively different from the erotic relationship to the good and to the just? Namely, I've been trying to think a lot now about the different dimensions of, let's say, these three principal ideals, the just, the beautiful, and the good, and wondering if the beautiful has a certain kind of primacy, as you point out, because it does shine forth, but whether or not sort of there's a different dynamic or a similar but different dynamic to Socrates' erotic relationship to the good, let's say, in the Republic, or actually we could just take it in any of the dialogues. Do you have some thoughts on this sort of just the beautiful of and the good question?
So here are at least my preliminary thoughts. As you said, correctly citing me, the beautiful is initially attractive, and I think it may be attractive in two different senses. One is the obvious sensual meaning of the beautiful, that is, we just human beings are just attracted to it. Mm-hmm. But then I think the second way in which we're attracted is the non-utility of the beautiful. That is, here's something that attracts us, but if we ask ourselves why, there isn't an answer. And particularly if one retains the connotation or the meaning of noble along with the beautiful in Greek. So I think that the beautiful is an attraction for human beings in general, and so as in the symposium involved in sexuality and regeneration, etc. It's just something that's naturally attracting to us as sensual beings, although I'm not sure, I have cats, that animals are attracted in the same way. So that indicates there's something intellectual about it also. But then it seems to me that when we think about the beautiful, or maybe the noble works better for this, it's also puzzling the way the different sizes of fingers are. After the initial attraction, then it also awakens one's mind, because it really is a very difficult problem for human beings to say that there is something that's noble in itself, or we might say, I think, moral in itself. Yes, if you're Kant, but you know, not so immediately for almost everybody else. Right. So I think the beautiful is that which attracts us initially by nature, but then its status by nature becomes a problem. The just, on the other hand, I think is not so attractive initially. That's the story of the Republic. You know, Glaucon's a very good gentleman. So first, when Socrates asked him whether he agrees with Thrasymachus, and he knows that, of course, no, you don't say that you would do something just because it's in your self-interest. But book two, he admits, well, yeah, I'm not convinced that it's better to live justly than it is to live unjustly if you can get away with it. So justice is something that human beings perceive as obligatory, as being forced on them in order to get ahead or to protect themselves, and not being as attractive in itself. It maybe becomes more attractive when it's associated with order. But it's still, I think, sort of at the opposite pole of the beautiful. It's the necessary, and also, for that reason, rational. But as I say, I don't think as attractive in itself. And so finally, the good, which Socrates doesn't always present as the idea of the good, that's, I think, only in the Republic. But what he says in the Republic in introducing that notion does seem to me to be true, and that is human beings are willing to settle for the apparently beautiful and the apparently just. But we aren't really willing to settle for the apparently good. We want what's really good. And I think that insight is at the core of Socratic philosophy. That is, human beings do really, truly want what's good. We don't agree about what that is. We don't have very clear notions of what that is, but that's our deepest and central desire.
Yeah. So, I mean, and I think in that sense, these three ideals, the just, the beautiful, and the good, do interrelate in interesting ways. I mean, just in your discussion, you were already bringing the beautiful after the initial sensual dimensions of it toward the good by talking about the noble, and I think the just too, in a way, is as you say necessary and rational, perhaps maybe not as initially attractive, but I see the question of justice as an ideal at work in particular ways between human beings in our relationships with one another. And right. I think that the notion that Socrates is his whole life is really animated by this erotic desire for the good, as, and therefore also the beautiful and the just, is exactly right. And I wonder, though you pointed to this, that this involves, that this erotic relationship to these ideals involves a recognition of one's own limits, so that they always have a dimension of elusiveness or something that we can never possess, and Socrates' awareness of that and his being unwilling to cover that over is something that I think marks him out as definitively different from some of the other characters, certainly in the Platonic dialogues, but maybe even also these other philosophers that you point to.
Yes, and I think that's true. I mean, I associate that inside of Socrates, particularly with the Symposium, when he's described the so-called ladder of love, how we move from an attraction to particular beautiful things to a desire to see the beautiful in itself. But then what he says is, you know, this, like all human knowledge, is fleeting, so you have to replenish your knowledge as you replenish your nutrition physically. But also, it seems to me very important and not altogether noticed that what he actually says about that fleeting vision of the good is that it's the search to achieve it that actually makes people virtuous. Mm-hmm. So I think it's virtue or excellence for Socrates has more to do with the direction of human desires than necessarily the satisfaction of those desires.
Mm-hmm. So maybe this brings us, because we had talked a little bit over email too about focusing a little bit of attention on the Phaedo, and I think there's arguably no better dialogue, but of course you could make this claim about no better dialogue in which this exact issue of one's erotic relationship to these ideals or these forms, these ideas, and yet an awareness, an acute awareness of finitude and limitation comes into play. And maybe we could talk a little bit about the Phaedo also with regard to the question of the difference between Plato and Socrates, so that we might come to one of the things I've been working on trying to articulate is the difference between the things Socrates says in the dialogues and the way the dialogues are crafted as pieces of writing that do things with us. And so I've been trying to think a lot in trying to write this book on the difference between Socratic and Platonic politics, by arguing that, you know, there's something very similar going on with the things Socrates does with his interlocutors and the things Platonic writing is trying to do with us readers. So turning us toward the question of the good and the just and the beautiful, but also cultivating in us a recognition of our own finitude and a certain relationship to that finitude.
So maybe I would introduce a dialogue which deals also with writing and eros, and say that we might begin with what appears to be or what is Socrates' criticism of writing in the Phaedrus. Mm-hmm. Nietzsche says, Socrates, he who doesn't write. Right. So the obvious difference, and in some ways emphatic difference, between Socrates, as shown by Plato, who's always engaged immediately in conversations with individuals, and Plato, who established the Academy and also wrote all these dialogues, he stands more in the background. Mm. And he clearly wrote, so... Mm-hmm. Was he disagreeing with his teacher? Or how did he understand this? So one way I would begin is looking back at the Phaedrus and the critique of writing that occurs at the end of the second half of the Phaedrus, when Socrates and Phaedrus have gone back to look at Lysias. Socrates actually draws together speaking and writing in the second half of the dialogue and defends Lysias from the accusation that Phaedrus relates that, oh, well, he's just a sophist because he writes speeches instead of gives them. So actually, speeches and writing have some of the same difficulties. If you were to give a long argument orally from Socrates' point of view, that would have the same difficulties as a writing. At most, you would be conveying opinions. You wouldn't be conveying knowledge. So you might remind somebody of something they had thought before. And if you were there and if you could answer questions, then it would be somewhat better. Mm-hmm. But I think the essential insight, which the dialogues, I believe, convey as well, is that knowledge isn't actually conveyed by my telling you. Mm-hmm. The most that can be communicated that way would be an opinion. So that everything that we know has this kind of mediate status. It's mediated by our senses, but it's also mediated even when it's entirely in speech. Okay. Because in order to understand something, everybody has to think it out for himself or herself. So the function of the speech or the argument, and then the function of conversation or dialogue and dialectic from Socrates' point of view is... for someone to think out the opinions they have, and this happens best in conversation because you have somebody else to question you about it. But I think that's also the need for questioning and the fact that all that can be conveyed are opinions is why the critique of writing for Socrates is also connected to the critique of law. He never legislates, mm-hmm. because laws are also writings, but they're also opinions, authoritative opinions, and don't have and can't really get the status of knowledge. So then if we shift back to the Phaedo, it seems to me that in the last moments of Socrates' life, this issue is raised again, explicitly in the dialogue, when they discover that he's sitting there writing,
right,
changing Aesop's fable into verse.
Yeah, right.
Because Socrates has this really sophisticated definition of a poet in the Republic too, which is it's verse or it's not. If it's not verse, it's not poetry. If it is verse, it is.
Right.
Or sound poetic. So Socrates is writing, and this is also the dialogue that begins by letting us know that Plato wasn't there.
Right.
So there seems to be this difference. Question one raised by Nietzsche, does that mean that Socrates is regretting that he didn't write? Because after all, he's about to leave his friends. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it have been better if he had left them something more to remember him by? And at least as I understand the dialogue, Socrates isn't leaving them so much with, well, no, he's not leaving them really with an argument about the immortality of the soul, so much as he's leaving them with a model of how one lives and how one dies, and which is this continual asking of questions in conversation with others, of what he understands to be philosophy.
Right. If we think then about the taking what you've said about I think I agree with you completely about the nature of the Phaedo with regard to it being about, you know, how to live an excellent finite life. And if we take that and then look a little bit at the structure of the dialogue itself and think about the fact that now turning our attention to a little bit about Plato's craft and writing it, having the dialogue be narrated by Phaedo to a friend, and situating it in that context, beginning with that, having it sort of intrude in throughout different moments in the dialogue, and then come back at the end. There's a way in which what you have being performed in the dialogue itself is the proof that Socrates was successful in convincing at least Phaedo and perhaps others to not to become misologues, not to give up on logos, but to continue to address one another and to seek for the truth. In this case, it is the truth about Socrates that Echecrates is asking at the beginning of the dialogue. And so then what you have is the dialogue in a certain sense showing us readers something different than what Socrates shows the interlocutors there, but also something very similar, namely, don't be misologues.
And I guess I would push the point even a little bit further. It seems to me significant that so many of Socrates' regular companions who are said to have been present on the day of his death, so including both Phaedo and Echecrates, but also Antisthenes and Euclides, and there's another one, Aeschines, yes. They all established schools. And so I think what that indicates is if you think about the action of the Phaedo, here you have this group of friends. They're not all Athenians, so you know, they established their schools elsewhere. But they're coming every day to meet with Socrates in his cell, so to an enclosed place. And what do they do there? Well, they have philosophical conversations. And so the point of those conversations can't, or at least the outcome wasn't, that they all agreed on all of the conclusions because the schools are different. But what they saw was the importance of continuing the conversations, which means keeping the questions open, but also doing this in a company of friends. That is, this isn't really a solitary activity. And if it's not a solitary activity, you've got to convince other people to cooperate while you're there and to carry it on. So right. I like you take the fact that the people who are inquiring about this and then who record Socrates' death, that they went out and formed the philosophical schools to be testimony to his success of having passed on a certain kind of legacy. Yeah. And I think that one could even understand Plato's activity then to be something of the same nature, that he's conveying to us and to later generations through writing the character of Socratic activity, because it's not delivered as a doctrine.
Right. Yeah, and so I mean, just to amplify a couple of points. I mean, I think the if you look at what Socrates does with his companions in the Phaedo, right in the middle, they're all depressed because you know maybe the soul's going to blow away, And he rallies them. Phaedo comes and says to Echecrates, you know, he's never more wondrous than when he did this. And so this ability to rally his colleagues, to continue the dialogue, to continue the discussion, to not become frustrated by Logoi, is itself then fits very well into the story, this larger story that you know, I think we're both now articulating, which is that there is an attempt to articulate how the philosophical endeavor is ongoing, it's communal, and now I'd like to push a little bit in about the question of writing and maybe schools or institutions, because if you're right about the fact that we have some people who were there who established schools and Plato himself having established the school. What is lost in the, or let me put it this way, the same concerns that Socrates articulates about writing in the Phaedrus seem to be at work in the establishing of schools or institutions, that they can become receptacles for dead thinking and not the living questioning that Socrates seems to want to keep reawakening, or and does keep reawakening. And I wonder about that tension, because Plato seems to have, despite the fact that his own writing is often calcified into a systematic philosophical doctrine, he seems to have at least hit upon a way of writing that at least could lend itself, if read properly, on my view, and I think on yours, to cultivate in others this ongoing questioning. But it's still, that danger from the Phaedrus is still operating, and it's a very real one, that it will become calcified, that it will become doctrinaire and handed down in this way.
Yes, and I guess Plato himself wasn't entirely able to escape that, because the Academy produced, in a way, both the Stoics or dogmatists and extreme skeptics, and neither of the later schools seems to be entirely true to Plato. What I take from the school, then, I think even the term schools or school of philosophy for us, I mean, it tends more in the doctrinal direction than it does in the company direction. So I don't think that I have a perfect answer to that. I mean, I do think that Plato not only wrote dialogues, but that's actually one of the main reasons I think he had not just Socrates, but these other philosophers, that he wanted to prevent a hardening of the doctrine by showing or dramatizing the difficulties with it. And I think that his school was free. It also was open not only to Athenians, but others. So it was private, and wasn't connected with any public authority. All those things were attempts to avoid the rigidification. But I guess on the other side of the Phaedo that I think is important, and then I think that Plato had to try to capture in his dialogues, to the extent to which they were true to his understanding of the Socratic spirit, was that if one understands philosophy always to be the search, it can be pretty frustrating. How's this different from Sisyphus pushing that rock up?
Exactly.
And so I think that there's a need to give at least some reasonable judgments or opinions, and that those come out of the dialogues. So actually, you should be just, you should be law-abiding. They aren't skeptical in an immoral sense. They're also very strong, and you have to consider your opinions, be open to challenges, but also to give reasons. And giving reasons for almost anything tends to make one moderate. So what they're not, and what the opposed image of what a school would be at the end of the Phaedrus is the school of Isocrates, which would be teaching people philosophy in order to become good speakers. Maybe there's not so much of that in our context, but that certainly was the dominant immediate context into which Plato wrote. And I think what he wasn't doing by writing dialogues, and certainly wasn't doing as a historical figure, so far as we know about that, was being a rhetorician in the obvious sense.
Right. And I think the notion of philosophy as searching is so powerfully portrayed in the Phaedo, with Socrates really sort of showing this tenacious willingness to continue to question in the face of his own death. And I think there's something that as you say, that it's difficult to stay in that place. And so it makes some sense that that institutions and schools do emerge. But the point that you made, I thought really well just now, was the difference between doctrine and the doctrine dimension of a school and the company dimension of a school. And I wonder if, you know, relating this to our current days and times is, you know, what we do in our classroom when we teach Plato with our students is, I think, in a way, hopefully, an attempt to recapture some of the company dimension of it, depending on, of course, how he's taught. I mean, I'm sure he's taught in a very doctrinaire way in many places. But also the institution of a university and of colleges, they allow that to happen year after year, generation after generation. So there's something about the stability of the institution that allows for that, that can allow for that. In the same way, I think that the stability of writing, like the written text of Plato, allow for us each time to come to it with the questions we have, and to be cultivated in us by reading this desire for the good and the just and the beautiful, but also the recognition of its elusiveness, of their elusiveness.
Yes, I find myself in the position where you have perhaps already been, and that I'm about to give a lecture on why study Plato, because he appears to be, well, he is one of those old white men, and could appear to a lot of young people to be perfectly irrelevant to their lives. And so my argument is that, on the contrary, it's the modeling of the conversations and the asking of the questions. That's what's important about Plato. And I think the dialogues, because of their play-like character, really invite students to join in. I expect this is an experience you've had, but I find it amusing that students are so relieved when they discover that, yeah, it's okay to criticize Socrates. He really gives some pretty bad arguments.
Right.
But when you're able to criticize Socrates, then you're already joining in the issue, and the issues raised by the noble, the just, and the and the good, these are still things that we care about, and we care very strongly about them. And I also think the insight, I suppose primarily of the Phaedo, but of the late dialogues, the Apology, Crito, and Socrates and Phaedo taken together, that the source of so much human evil and irrationality is our fear of death.
Yeah.
And Socrates' repeated arguments, which do make sense to me, that it is irrational to fear death.
Hmm.
This is something that's going to happen. You see it all around. It doesn't make sense to fear it. But that this goes so contrary to some of the, you know, I think the deepest animal instincts of human beings, that you need someone to model that the way Socrates does. This is actually possible.
Okay. Well, and I think the wonderful thing about your book and is that it really does show that in the context of all the dialogues in an amazing way. So I, for all those who may be listening to this podcast, I recommend this book. And Catherine, thank you so much for coming on the Digital Dialogue.
Thank you for having me.
This has been the Digital Dialogue.
Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons Share and Share Alike license. If you'd like to learn more about the Digital Dialogue, I invite you to visit my website at www.la.psu.edu/Chris Long and on the Digital Dialogue Facebook page at www.facebook.com/digitaldialogue. You can also find the Digital Dialogue now on Google+. Thank you for listening to the Digital Dialogue.